Welcome to the Series 7 Top-Off Study Guide, audio lessons for the new Series 7 exam. It's taken me a while. I've been at this for months, and I finally completed it. And I'm going to be offering some sample lessons to you in the podcast, the Series 7 podcast. Also, I'm going to put the sample lessons in the SIE podcast, the Securities Industries Essentials Exam podcast. And also probably in CD Baby. And wherever I can put these out there, I'm going to share these with you. Also, you are going to be able to sign up for these sample lessons at the website. So you will get multiple opportunities to download these lessons and see if they make sense for you. I'm going to be sharing 6 lessons with you, starting with lesson number 2. I'm skipping over the first lesson, which is basically an introduction to the Series 7 top-off exam, the new Series 7 exam. And I'm going straight into the guts of the material, starting out with lesson number 2. Now, if you decide that these lessons are valuable to you, you can always go to the website and purchase the full bundle of audio lessons. The website is series7podcast.com. The total length of this series of audio lessons, this full course, is 32 hours and 27 minutes in length. It's 74 individual lessons. Now, I've gone through all of my old Series 7 lessons, and I've had to create quite a few new lessons for the top-off study guide, the Series 7 top-off study guide. And I've had to modify the ones that were not new. There is a big difference between the old Series 7 exam and the new Series 7 exam. The new Series 7 exam, while there are fewer questions and you have less time to complete it, what you are expected to have as a knowledge base includes all of the new information contained in the top-off Series 7 exam, as well as the information that you learned to prepare for the Securities Industries Essentials exam. There's going to be a lot of questions on rules and regulations, and also a lot of questions on suitability. In other words, you're going to have to go back to your product knowledge of the different investment products that you learned about in the Securities Industries Essentials exam, and then apply your best efforts in determining suitability for different clients. So we're going to be talking about suitability of different investments in many of the lessons where we're also talking about product. And by product, I mean the investment choices that a client might choose to invest in, or you might suggest to your client that he purchase. Now, when you're going to make a suggestion, make sure that you know enough about that client to make a suitable suggestion. And we will be covering why in the series of audio lessons. All right, let's get on to the lessons. This is the second sample lesson for the Series 7 Top-Off Study Guide, audio lessons for the new Series 7 exam. This lesson is on rankings, volatility ratings, and CMOs. The total length of this lesson is 31 minutes and 22 seconds. Welcome to the Series 7 Top-Off Exam audio lessons. This is lesson number 3, and we are going to start out by talking about FINRA Rule 2212, which is the use of investment company rankings in retail communications. So basically, if you're going to be talking to your customer about investment companies and showing the rankings of that investment company versus other investment companies, there are certain rules that you must adhere to. I'm looking right at the regulation, which is at finra.compliantnet.com, and I'm going to read this to you, the definition of a ranking entity. For the purpose of this rule, the term ranking entity refers to any entity that provides general information about investment companies to the public. That is independent of the investment company and its affiliates, and whose services are not procured by the investment company or any of its affiliates to assign the investment company a ranking. So in other words, investment company rankings must be independently arrived at, not internally generated by the investment company. And in general, here's a prohibition. Members may not use investment company rankings in any retail communication other than rankings created and published by ranking entities. You might call Morningstar a ranking entity. Or two, rankings created by an investment company or an investment company affiliate, but based on performance measurements of a ranking entity. In other words, let's say mutual fund XYZ rates itself. If it is going to rate itself, it has to be based on performance measurements of a ranking entity. And then it goes on to say, ranking in retail communications must also conform to the following requirements. And these are the disclosures. A headline or other prominent statement must not state or imply that an investment company or investment company family is the best performer in a category unless it is actually ranked first in the category. And then it goes on to say, all retail communications containing an investment company ranking must disclose prominently the name of the category, such as, let's say, an income fund, a growth fund, a balance fund, whatever the category is, that's what it is being ranked for. The number of investment companies that are in that category, the name of the ranking entity, such as Morningstar, the length of the period or the first day of the period and the ending date for which it is being ranked for, and the criteria on which the ranking is based. Is it total return, risk-adjusted performance, whatever? Okay, and then the other required disclosures is the standard one, that past performance is no guarantee of future results. And then for investment companies that assess front-end sales loads, whether the rankings take those loads into account. So if you charge a front-end load for the fund, does that ranking take into account that front-end load? For instance, let's say you invested $100 in XYZ fund. When the net asset value of that fund was $100 a share, and a year later it's $110 a share, they would say they had a 10% increase in value in that fund. But let's face it, if you invest $100 into an investment company and you pay a 5% load, your return is going to be less than 10%. So does that ranking take into account the load? And then it goes on to say, if the ranking is based on total return or the current SEC standardized yield and fees have been waived or expenses advanced during the period of the ranking and the waiver had a material effect on the total return or yield for that, a statement to that effect. So that has to be disclosed. Also, what has to be disclosed is the publisher of the ranking. Was it ABC Magazine, Money Magazine, let's say Morningstar, wherever that ranking is coming from has to be stated prominently in the disclosures of a ranking. Then finally, you have to disclose what the ranking consists of. For instance, is it a 5-star system and what that really means? Is a 4-star ranking and a 5-star system, how many investment companies actually are in that 4-star category? How many are in the 1-star category? How many are in the 2-star category? So you couldn't have a ranking system where everybody was rated a 5-star because that really would not be a ranking system at all. Now, when you're talking to the public about rankings, it has to be current ranking. It must be current rankings. So I'll read this. Any investment company ranking included in a retail communication must be, at a minimum, current to the most recent calendar quarter ended prior to the use or submission for publication. If no ranking that meets this requirement is available from the ranking entity, then a member may only use the most current ranking available from the ranking entity, unless use of the most current ranking would be misleading. So, for instance, one company might have changed its accounting standards and it has a tremendous increase in its ranking, primarily as a result of an accounting change. that would be misleading. So you would not use that current ranking if there was some extenuating circumstances that greatly biased the current ranking. Let's talk about yield rankings. Goes on to say, except for money market funds, any retail communication may not present any ranking that covers a period of time less than a year, unless the ranking is based on yield. And then it says, an investment company ranking based on total return must be based on total return for a one-year period, for investment companies in existence for at least 1 year, 1 to 5 year periods for investment companies that have been in existence for at least 5 years, and 10-year periods for investment companies that have been around for 10 years. In other words, you can't pick and choose what rankings the company you're going to show. So you might have had a fund that's been in existence for 30 years, and if you only show the last 5 years where they might have had phenomenal performance, you are misleading. You need to show the history of that fund. Let's talk about categories. The choice of category, including a subcategory of a broader category on which the investment company rankings is based, must be one that provides a sound basis for evaluating the performance of the investment company. And it goes on to say, an investment company ranking must be based only on a published category or subcategory created by a ranking entity, or a category or subcategory created by an investment company or an investment company affiliated, but based on the performance measurements of a ranking entity. So that's sort of like saying, if you are doing the financial reports for a company, it must be based on generally accepted accounting procedures. Well, investment companies' rankings must be based on a ranking entity's measurements. You can't create your own measurements for ranking and entity. And then finally, under categories, it says retail communication must not use any category or subcategory that is based upon the asset size of an investment company or the investment company family, whether or not it has been created by a ranking entity. So let's say you have an investment company that has a 12b1 fund, a front-end load fund, a rear-end load fund, or a no-load fund, but they're all the same portfolio. These are called multiple class or two-tier funds. Investment companies for more than one class of investment company with the same portfolio must be accompanied by prominent disclosures of the fact that the investment companies or classes have a common portfolio and different expense structures. And then finally, let's talk about investment company families in section 2212. Retail communications may contain rankings of investment company families, provided that these rankings comply with this rule, and further, provided that no retail communication for an individual investment company may provide a ranking of an investment company family unless it also prominently discloses the various rankings for the individual investment company supplied by the same ranking entity. All right, I think basically when you're communicating rankings of investment companies to your potential customer or to the potential investor, you need to make sure all these disclosures are prominently made to the investor, because it's very easy to lie with statistics. And so this is basically an attempt to make sure that you are consistent in your presentation of investment company performances or rankings. All right, let's move on to Rule 2213. And this one is called Requirements for the Use of Bond Mutual Fund Volatility Ratings. So first of all, we define it. This is always how these work out. First of all, you have to define what you're talking about. So let me read the definition of bond mutual fund volatility ratings. So let's read the definition. For the purposes of this rule and any interpretation, the term bond mutual fund volatility is a description issued by an independent third party relating to the sensitivity of the net asset value of a portfolio of an open-end management investment company that invests in debt securities to changes in market conditions and the general economy, and is based on an evaluation of objective factors, including the credit quality of the fund's individual portfolio holdings, the market price volatility of the portfolio, the fund's performance, and specific risks such as interest rate risk, prepayment risk, and currency risk. All right, so let's just talk about that for a second. Basically, let's talk about the different types of funds you might have. Let's say you have a government bond fund that only invests in short-term treasury bills. And correspondingly, another fund that is highly leveraged, let's say leveraged 2-to-1, that invests in junk bonds. Well, the volatility of the junk bonds is going to be higher, just thinking about this logically, because number one, it's leveraged. It's using borrowed money to buy speculative investments. And number two, the value of that portfolio can go up and down much greater than, let's say, a 3-month treasury bill. So that's what we're talking about here. All right, let's continue on reading. Prohibitions on use. Members and persons associated with a member may use the bond mutual fund volatility rating only in a communication that is accompanied or preceded by a prospectus for the bond mutual fund, and only when the following requirements are satisfied. So first of all, they have to have a prospectus when you're talking to them about volatility, or they have to have had it already. But let's continue on these other requirements. The rating does not identify or describe volatility as a risk rating. Number two, the supplemental sales literature incorporates the most recent available rating and reflects information that, at a minimum, is current to the most recently completed calendar quarter ended prior to use. Three, the criteria and methodology used to determine the rating must be based exclusively on objective, quantifiable factors. The rating and the disclosure statement that accompanies the rating must be clear, concise, and understandable. It can't be a bunch of legalese. And then going on, it says, the supplemental sales literature conforms to the disclosure requirements described in paragraph C. And we'll talk about paragraph C in a second. And then finally, the entity that issues the rating provides detailed disclosures on its rating methodology to investors through a toll-free telephone number, a website, or both. So there must be information available easily to the person you're presenting this information to. Okay, let's talk about the disclosure requirements, which they talked about as C. First of all, supplemental sales literature containing a bond mutual fund volatility rating shall include a disclosure statement containing all the information that is required by this rule. The disclosure statement may contain any additional information that is relevant to an investor's understanding of the rating. And two, supplemental sales literature containing a bond mutual fund volatility rating shall contain all current bond mutual fund volatility ratings that have been issued with respect to the fund. Information concerning multiple ratings may be combined in the disclosure statement, provided that the applicability of the information to each rating is clear. All right, then we go on to say all bond mutual fund volatility ratings shall be contained within the text of the disclosure statement. The following disclosures shall be provided with respect to each such rating. First of all, the name of the entity that's issued the rating. Next, the most current rating and date of the current rating with an explanation of the reason for any change in the current rating from the most recent prior rating. So if there's been material change, that needs to be disclosed. And then C, a description of the rating in narrative form containing the following disclosures. So we go on in another sub paragraph to say a statement that there is no standard method for assigning ratings. Then a description of the criteria and methodology used to determine the rating. Then a statement that not all bond funds have volatility ratings. And then whether consideration was paid in connection with obtaining the issuance of a rating. which would not be surprising if you're paying Standard & Poor's for this information. You would be paying them for that information. Okay, and then we go on to say a description of the types of risk the rating measures, for example, short-term volatility. And next, a statement that the portfolio may have changed since the date of the rating, and then a statement that there is no guarantee that the fund will continue to have the same rating or perform in the future as rated. All right, that covers section 2213. All right, the next FINRA rule we are going to cover is rule number 2216, and this is entitled Communications with the Public About Collateralized Mortgage Obligations. And in parentheses, it says CMOs, which are the common acronym for collateralized mortgage obligations. Now, before we get into this, collateralized mortgage obligations can become very complicated, and the yields are not predetermined. And so this is a section that you probably need to understand because it may be one that you get a question or two on. Because collateralized mortgage obligations, just by their very nature, let's talk about what they are. They're the opposite side of a car payment or a house payment or something else that is providing the collateral. And therefore, there may be prepayment risks and there may be credit risks. And so you need to make sure when you are talking to your clients about collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs, that you explain to them what they are buying into. All right, a little bit of a history. Ginnie Mae is a collateralized mortgage obligation. Government National Mortgage Association. Years ago, I had a client that bought some Ginnie Mae's from me, and I explained to them, listen, what you're buying here is the opposite side of a home mortgage. And so each month on your statement, you're going to see the value of this Ginnie Mae go down because every month you are getting part principal and part interest back. So in a period of time, the value of this will go to zero. There's not one payment date in the future like you do when you have a bond or a treasury bill or a treasury note. The money, the principal is paid back usually monthly on CMOs. And so you explain this to your client, and inevitably after a few months goes by, they call up and say, listen, I put $1,000 into that Ginnie Mae and now it's only worth $850. What happened? And you had to calmly explain to them that what happened is $150 of principal has been paid or prepaid or has come back to you. So you've gotten that money back. You didn't lose it. It's just sitting in a different part of your account. But nonetheless, that's the issue you have when you're going to be talking to clients about collateralized mortgage obligations. So with that preamble out of the way, let's just talk about what they expect you to disclose to your customer when you're talking to them about CMOs. All right, let's go into this. Definition. For the purpose of this rule, the term collateralized mortgage obligation refers to a multi-class debt instrument backed by a pool of mortgage pass-through securities or mortgage loans, including real estate mortgage, investment conduits, as defined by the Tax Reform Act of 1986. Now, I said it might include automobile loans. Well, for this purpose, CMOs do not consider auto loans as part of this. They would be another type of investment. This one is dealing primarily with real estate loans that are the opposite side of a home loan mortgage. All right, let's continue on. Disclosure standards and required educational material. This assumes your client can read these materials and understand them. Okay, this disclosure standards. All retail communications and correspondence concerning CMOs, A, must include within the name of the product the term collateralized mortgage obligation. B, may not compare CMOs to any other investment vehicle, including a bank certificate of deposit. C, must disclose as applicable that a government agency backing applies only to the face value of the CMO and not to any premium paid. And D, must disclose that a CMO's yield and average life will fluctuate depending on the actual rate at which the mortgage holder prepay the mortgages underlying the CMO and changes in the current interest rates. Now, when I started out in the business, I didn't have to make these disclosures to the client. I tried to explain it to them, but these disclosures are required now. All right, so continuing on, required educational material. Before the sale of a CMO to any person other than an institutional investor, as defined in Rule 2210, and we've already talked about what an institutional investor is, a member must offer to the person educational material that includes the following. A discussion of the characteristics and risks of CMOs, including credit quality, prepayment rates, and average lives, interest rates, including the effect on value and prepayment rates, tax consideration, minimum investment, transaction costs, and liquidity. And a side note, in 2008, CMOs plunged. There was no liquidity in CMOs, and that's why it led to a bank bailout by the Federal Reserve. The bank went and bought all these mortgage loans from banks and put them on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. So liquidity can be very touchy on CMOs. Okay, let me continue on. So continuing on, part two on this, the structure of a CMO, including the various types of tranches that may be issued, and the rights and risks pertaining to each, including the fact that two CMOs with the same underlying collateral may be prepaid at different rates and may have different price volatility. And the last point, the relationship between mortgage loans and mortgage securities. And then you also have to have a discussion with the investor of what the investor should ask before investing, and finally, a glossary of terms. So this is the required educational material. So you're going to have sort of a frequently asked question section on this, and also a glossary of terms. Now, we are going to cover in great detail CMOs in a later lesson. So I'm not going to go into it much more than that right now. But continuing on with this regulation, 2216, FINRA Rule 2216, we're going to continue on with Part C, Promotion of Specific CMOs. In addition to the standards set forth above, retail communications and correspondence that promote a specific security or contain yield information must conform to the standards set forth below. An example of a compliant communication appears at the end of this rule. So let me tell you what the retail communication requirements are. A retail communication or correspondence must present the following disclosures in equal prominence. The information in Section 1 and 2 must be included, and the information in Section 3 is optional. Therefore, the members may elect to include any, all, or none of this information. The information in Section 4 may be tailored to the member's preferred signature. So let's go through what Section 1 is. Section 1 is the title, and then it says collateralized mortgage obligation, the coupon rate, the anticipated yield, the average life, the specific tranche, and the number of class of that tranche, the final maturity date, and the underlying collateral. Section 2 is the disclosure statement, and this includes the yield and average life shown in the first section, and consider prepayment assumptions that may or may not have been met. Changes in payments may significantly affect yield and average life. Then it says, please contact your representative for information on CMOs and how they react to different market conditions. So that is it. Information in Section 1 and 2 must be included, and the Section 3 is optional. So let's go on to Section 3. Section 3 is product features, minimum denominations, rating disclosures, agency or government backing. So for instance, it may be Ginnie Mae agency backing or full faith and credit of the U.S. government backing it, or no government backing. Income and payment structure, general description of the tranche, the yield to maturity of CMOs offered at par. So they're assuming all the bonds bought in the portfolio are bought at par. And then Section 5 is company information, name and memberships, the address, telephone number, and the representative's name. And so this is one of those things, look for the fine print. Well, they're not letting you put any fine print in this. So these are the additional conditions. The following additional conditions must be met. All figures in Section 1 must be of equal type size. Let's go over what Section 1 is. Section 1 is the coupon rate, the anticipated yield and average life, the specific tranche, number, and class, the final maturity date, and the underlying collateral. The disclosure language in Section 2 may not be altered and must be given equal prominence with information in Section 1. And C, the prepayment assumption used to determine the yield and average life must be either obtained from a nationally recognized service or the member must be able to justify the assumption used. A copy of either the service listing for the CMO or the member's justification must be attached to the copy of the communication that is maintained in the member's advertising file in order to verify that the prepayment scenario is reasonable. And then finally, D, any sales charge that the member intends to impose must be reflected in the anticipated yield. Section E of this says the communication must include language stating that the security is offered subject to prior sale and price change. This language may be included in any one of the four sections. So that communication must be in there somewhere. And then finally, if the security is an accrual bond that does not currently distribute principal and interest payments, then Section 1 must include this information. An accrual bond would be like a zero coupon bond, and we'll talk about those later on. All right, let's talk about radio and television advertisements of CMOs. The following oral disclaimer must precede any radio or television advertisement in lieu of the title information set forth in Section 1. And so it says, you would have to say, the following is an advertisement for collateralized mortgage obligations. Contact your representative for information on CMOs and how they react to different market conditions. And then Section B says, radio or television advertisements must contain the following oral disclosure statement in lieu of the legend set forth in Section 2. The yield and average, and this is what it says, this is what must be stated. The yield and average life reflect prepayment assumptions that may or may not be met. Changes in payments may significantly affect yield and average life. All right, so now it's going to give us an example of what is all kosher. Let me read this to you. This is an actual advertisement for a CMO. Now, I'm assuming, and I may or may not be wrong, that this is for an initial offering of CMOs and not the secondary market for CMOs, because I can't imagine finding all this information for the secondary market for CMOs. But that's just my editorial comment. I've sold CMOs in the past, and I never provided this information because they were all off the secondary market. But I made sure my clients understood what CMOs were and how they might react. Okay, so let's give you an example of what is an acceptable CMO communication. So it says, collateralized mortgage obligations at the top. And this, all this lettering is in exactly the same size and the same font. Okay, going on. 7.5% coupon. 7.75% anticipated yield to a 22-year average life. FNMA 9532X, final maturity March 2023. So that's the specific security. Collateral 100% FNMA, which means Fannie Mae, 7.5%. So that's telling you what the security is. Federal National Mortgage Association is what FNMA stands for. All right, then it goes on to say, the yield and average life shown above reflect prepayment assumptions that may or may not be met. Changes in payments may significantly affect yield and average life. Please contact your representative for information on CMOs and how they react to different market conditions. $5,000 minimum, income paid monthly, implied rating, volatility rating, principal and interest payments backed by FNMA or Fannie Mae, PAC bond, PAC bond, which I think stands for principal and coupon bond, offered subject to prior sale and price change. Call Mary representative at 800-555-1234. Your company Securities Inc., member of SPIC, 123 Main Street, any town, state, 12121. So that's just the supposed information on the company offering these. And that finishes up section 2216. All right, that's going to finish up this lesson. I think that's enough to cover. So in this lesson, we've covered FINRA Rule 2212, 2213, and 2216. In the next lesson, we are going to cover FINRA Rules 2220, which is option communications, 2330, which is members' responsibility regarding deferred variable annuities, and 2316, which is on options. That will finish up the FINRA rules in Section 1 that you need to cover for the top-off Series 7 examination. All right, thanks for listening to this sample lesson. If you decide you want to purchase the full bundle of audio lessons, go to the Series7Podcast.com, and that's Series and the number 7, so Series and the number 7 Podcast.com. Click on the Series 7 Top-Off Study Guide, Audio Lessons for the New Series 7 Exam, and it will take you to a service called Gumroad. Gumroad will take your credit card information and then send you an email link where you are allowed to listen to or download the MP3 files. Let me strongly suggest, that you take the time to download the individual audio files into your computer. The total length of this full series of audio lessons is 32 hours and 27 minutes. So download all the MP3 files to your computer and then take the time to upload the individual MP3 files that you want to listen to back to your listening device. This would take up a lot of storage space to put the full series of audio lessons onto your listening device. I provide in the download a PDF document which explains how to go through the process of downloading the MP3 files to your computer and then uploading them into your listening device. And I'm assuming by listening device, you're talking about an iPhone or another smartphone of some sort. You can also do it into the old-fashioned iPods if you want to do that. Gumroad does have an app which you can use to listen to the audio lessons, but I think you will have a lot of problems using the app. It has not been updated in quite a few years. I'm hoping that Sahil Lavinga, the founder of Gumroad, will be upgrading this app in the near future. But until then, if you want to purchase the full series of audio lessons, the best way to do it is to download it into your computer and then upload the individual MP3 files into your listening device. Now, a lot of people have asked me why I don't put the full series of audio lessons out on, let's say, a service like Audible or iTunes. Well, if I did that, they take such a big portion of my revenues that I would probably have to more than double the price that I charge you for this series of audio lessons. I try to keep the price reasonable and affordable to you. And if I uploaded it to those services, I just wouldn't get enough to justify the trouble that I go through to put these audio lessons together. All right. Best of luck in your studies. I hope you find these audio lessons useful.